I'm Carrie Fountain, and this is Just to Say, where we talk to poets about the poems they create and the poems that created them.
I'm trying to find a way to work around this idea of anti-translation and not just be kind of like someone's cultural tourist handholder, right? I don't want to just be the poet that's like, and now I will take you to the Mexican aisle at the grocery store and I will explain to you what chiles de árbol are. My name is Jose Guadalupe Olivares. This poem is called Mexican-American Disambiguation, after Idris Goodwin. My parents are Mexican, who are not to be confused with Mexican-Americans or Chicanos. I am a Chicano from Chicago, which means I am a Mexican-American with a fancy college degree and a few tattoos. My parents are Mexican, who are not to be confused with Mexicans still living in Mexico. Those Mexicans call themselves Mexicanos. White folks at parties call them pobrecitos. American colleges call them international students and diverse. My mom was white in Mexico, and my dad was mestizo, and after they crossed the border, they became diverse and minorities and ethnic and exotic. But my parents call themselves Mexicanos, who again should not be confused for Mexicanos living in Mexico. Those Mexicanos might call my family gringos, which is a word my family calls white folks, and white folks call my parents interracial. Colleges say, put them on a brochure. My parents say, ¿qué significa esa palabra? I point out that all the men in my family marry lighter-skinned women. That's a Chicano in me, which means it's a fancy college degrees in me, which is also diverse of me. Everything in me is diverse, even when I eat American foods like hamburgers, which, to clarify, are American when a white person eats them and diverse when my family eats them. So much of America can be understood like this. My parents were undocumented when they came to this country. And by undocumented, I mean sin papeles. And by sin papeles, I mean royally f***ed, which should not be confused with the American dream, though the two are cousins. Colleges are not looking for undocumented diversity. My dad became a citizen, which should not be confused with keys to the house. We were safe from deportation, which should not be confused with walking the plank, though they're cousins. I call that sociology, but that's just the Chicano in me who should not be confused with the diversity in me, or the Mexicano in me who is constantly fighting with the upwardly mobile in me, who is good friends with the Mexican-American in me, who the colleges love, but only on brochures, who the government calls non-white Hispanic or white Hispanic, who my parents call mijo, even when I don't come home so much.
I love the way that poem ends. I love everything about that poem.
Thank you.
What do you think of that word, disambiguation, and what you're sort of doing with it in this poem?
So what I'm doing, you know, by showing you all of the different ways that identity moves and is fluid, I'm trying to show you how hard it is to actually do this thing, to actually disambiguate. And the poem, you know, the poem is after Idris Goodwin. In his poem, it's like a lyric essay. It's called Preface, and it's in his first book. He's trying to do a similar thing with this idea of black. And you see that it's just identity is so fluid that even when we are trying to connect, it's a hard thing to do, to pin down.
And it's I love this poem because it really articulates that so well, and it there's like a freedom in it that just makes me like want to just honestly like yell hell yes when I hear this poem. And then I'm like, oh, this is it's so it's so I am half Mexican American and I grew up in southern New Mexico. And so, like, the word Chicano is really, like, foreign to me as, like, growing up. But the word Hispanic is, like, that's the word that if I was going to, like, disambiguate, I'd have to work on that word because that was the word in New Mexico that, like, had all of these implications to it because there's, you know, there's this huge Spanish influence. I mean, you know, this Spanish, you know. The Spanish conquered Mexico. I mean, no spoiler alert.
Right. So one of the things that that made me come to this poem is also how regional all of these titles are.
Right.
So when I was a student in Cambridge, Massachusetts, people would call me Spanish. And they meant Latinx, or they meant Hispanic, whatever word you prefer, right? But they just call people who speak Spanish, Spanish, regardless of if they're Dominican or from Spain or whatever, you know?
Right. And yes, yes, that's very, yes, yeah. I wanted you to talk a little bit, this line right here. Well, I guess I have to go up a little bit. My parents were undocumented when they came to this country, and by undocumented, I mean sin papeles, and by sin papeles, I mean royally fucked, which should not be confused with the American dream, though the two are cousins. It's just such a great turn. I think that's the first time we hear that phrase, though the two are cousins, and then you use it again. It's just really great, and I wondered if, I don't know if this would be hard to talk about, but I wonder if, like, you could speak a little bit. Not all poets are funny. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about, you know, how you approach humor, because it's so often in your poems. And I wonder if you think of yourself as like a funny poet, and what it feels like to be asked this question, because maybe it's a stupid question.
Yeah, no, I don't think it's a stupid question at all. I mean, I certainly like to consider myself a funny person. You know what I'm saying? I think, I don't know if I consider myself a funny poet. I definitely use humor. But what I'm using humor towards is surprise. Like, I've been writing a lot of these poems for a long time. This is my debut book of poems. And so that, like, I've written a bunch about identity, but it's only when I kind of turned towards humor that I was able to find some of the surprise and some of the heartbreak and tie it all together in a way that actually felt real to myself.
And so much of it is, I love that. And so much of it also is just about the way when you take the turn to speak in like a very familiar diction, like a diction that you as a young person use, you know, I think that can have the feeling of being funny or humorous. But you're right, it's sort of about that surprise, like reference this poem that I just I think this is a poem that has like become a very well-known poem from, there's a series of poems in your book called Mexican Heaven. And there's this one, oh God, now I can't find it. Oh, here, look, I have it on my phone. But it ends, you know, so it begins, it sort of has this kind of gravity to it in the beginning. And it says something super provocative, you know, oh, Mexican Heaven. There are white people in heaven too. You know, like this sort of, you know, okay, like that's a statement. They build condos across the street and ask the Mexicans to speak English, which is like the middle part of the poem. Like it's just like the setup. And then I'm just kidding. There are no white people in heaven. It's the turn there is like it really does hinge on a very like what you're saying, like a surprising and specific diction, a way of talking. Right. Oh, just kidding. You know, it's like very familiar and I think there's something about that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, for me, part of it is, so a lot of the book is taking autobiographic facts, but filtering them through this persona that is partly myself, but also honestly, the voice is really kind of belongs to like a mesh of my three siblings, my three brothers. And I think that's also partly where the humor comes from, like the way that they react to everything that happens in their lives. And I think that I've learned this from them is, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly. They always crack a joke first before they kind of open up into the emotional world. And I don't know. If that's just my brothers. I see it in my cousins, too. So I think, as I was trying to like think about this voice, and I was also trying to write towards my family, I started to notice that the voice that would help me, you know, and I say voice, but what I'm speaking about is, you know, partly that familiar language that you're talking about, partly the turns towards humor, partly this insistence on, how can I put it, reacting with surprise towards things that do have a lot of gravity. That's what I'm talking about. It comes, it's inspired from like having spent a ton of time with my brothers and seeing them always kind of crack a joke first, no matter what.
That's so interesting to think about the way our formal voices in our poems, you know, it's not just the self, but it's these other voices that inform that. Do you think that going forward, like in the poems that you're writing now, do you feel like that formal voice is changing, or is this, you know, is this carrying you forward as well? Is it?
I think the voice is changing in part because, you know, I'm experimenting right now, and so I don't know exactly what it is. The thing that I thought about doing was writing a series of anti-translation poems. So taking these ideas that are like very culturally significant to myself, maybe to Chicano people at large, Latinx people at large, but then writing them in a way where like if someone from the outside were viewing them, they would think that they had this expertise into something, but actually, you know, kind of lying to them. So I'm trying to find a way to work around this idea of anti-translation and not just be kind of like someone's like cultural tourist handholder, right? I don't want to just be the poet that's like, and now I will take you to, you know, the Mexican aisle at the grocery store and I will explain to you what chiles de árbol are. You know what I mean? Like, I want to be more than just like a translator. So how can I subvert that gaze is something that I'm trying to think about. And I don't know if it's going to use the same voice.
That's great. I think you do that so often in this book as well, subverting that.
Thank you again.
That produces this sort of sense of surprise, and it also has the speaker in the poems. It, you know, it's also about agency. You know, like that idea that you don't want to just sort of be this sort of like a tour guide to your culture or your experience. And this poem that you read, I think does that so well as I wanted to ask about, so this book, how long ago did this book come out?
This book came out in September 2018. So I think it's been like 6 or 7 months, 8 months, something like that.
So what were you doing 8 months ago when you were, I mean, this book came out and now I know because I follow you on social media, you're like everywhere, you're traveling everywhere. And I wonder, and you're teaching and you're giving readings and you're on the road and you are a poet whose voice people are very anxious to hear and they want to hear more and they want more and more and more. Like, tell me about the response to this book and how it's changed your, like, you know, your day-to-day life.
That's a good question. That's kind of the question for me right now. 8 months ago when my book of poems was released, the book is called Citizen Illegal, I was working at a literary nonprofit called Young Chicago Authors in Chicago, Illinois. And, you know, I remember planning for my book release party, which we did at the National Museum of Mexican Art in Chicago, and feeling very anxious that, you know, we went for a big room. I think the capacity of the room was like 200. And I was really anxious that it was going to be like, you know, my family members and like a handful of my friends, and that would be it. And since then, it feels like every week something new happens and more people pick it up, and it's completely transformed my life. You know, I now am mostly a full-time freelancer. I make my living by traveling and performing and teaching workshops. And I've conducted like I've done a ton of interviews. So I've also like developed the language for talking about my book, and I think really now I'm starting to really understand what I pulled off and what it means for me. But there's this other part, which is that all of the attention kind of makes me freak out also, and kind of makes me like want to shrink away from the world a little bit, that I don't know where that came from. You know, in a lot of ways, I've been able to do so much more than I ever dreamed of with this book. And now that I have it, it's kind of making me anxious and also wonder, like, it's made it really hard to write sometimes as I think about all those people listening. I think I think about it too much. And so I've been trying to stay out of my head. I've been trying to, like, take care of myself and keep trying to read as much as possible. But I think before the book came out, I had cultivated this routine of quiet and listening, and had gotten into a great rhythm with writing and reading and doing all of the things that kind of sustained my creative practice. And now, even as I have more time, in some ways, I find that, like, my creative practice has been totally, you know, disassembled, and I'm again trying to figure out how to make a new creative practice for myself.
That's so interesting. That's so interesting to think about that, and what you said about, like, the people listening. Like, how do you write poems when you know people are listening? Yeah, or you know, or sort of waiting for you. Yeah, that's really great. What have been the responses as you've traveled around? Like, what do people say to you about this book?
Well, I just got a Twitter message actually from a ninth grader somewhere, and they were like, I've never really read poetry and I've never really liked it, but I read this poem of yours and it completely clicked with me. And I think that's one of the responses that I get. A lot of people who, you know, maybe would not expect themselves to love poetry. I think sometimes people have a bias towards poetry for whatever reason. They find that they really enjoy my book regardless. And then there's always at schools, there are people who want to ask me about, like, how to write. And, you know, I don't want to use the word inspiring, but I think people are just really excited that my book is out, and hopefully it allows them ways to write their own poems and their own stories.
I'm glad that you're focusing on that self-care and, like, kind of trying to find that space where they're, you know, quiet is not just, you know, the experience of quiet in the moment, but it's also quieting those, you know, the whole rest of the world, so that you can then again become one individual person writing your own poems. You're not there to, you know, you're there to do that. That's your only job. Because really what you are doing when you're traveling and when you're teaching so much, and also I imagine when you become this person whose voice is, for some people, like you just said, I'd never read a poem before, or I never really got into poetry before, but this poem, you know, where you can sort of step back and just go, like, I'm just one person alone in a room writing. Like, that's also, you know, you have to protect that. And I'm glad that you're doing that as you're also being, like, a superstar on the road.
Thank you. I don't know about a superstar, but I'm trying my best.
Because it is giving, don't you think it is? I mean, it feels to me when I do it, like teaching, is very mm-hmm. much it's a job. It's an expense of energy and like creative energy as well, not just sort of spiritual energy. And
absolutely. You know, for me, I often think of teaching as part of my creative practice. I think in some ways that's kind of what is throwing me off right now, is when I was working at Young Chicago Authors, there was a workshop that I could always count on teaching. And in preparing for the workshop and in listening to students kind of teach me about the poems that I was bringing to them, I was able to kind of dig into some of my own obsessions, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, you got to make it so that your life allows you to do that more, you know?
Yeah.
Were you an English major in college?
I was not.
Yeah, tell me about how you started writing poetry and, like, what were you studying, or what did you study?
So I started writing poetry in high school as part of Young Chicago Authors' Louder Than a Bomb poetry program. So I was super lucky. My high school had what's called the Poetry Slam Team. And then every February and March, we would take the bus into downtown Chicago and meet up with like 40 other schools that also had Poetry Slam Teams, and then have this like poetry festival where people shared poems. And for me, it was one of the first times that like around a group of my peers that I really felt at home. I mean, I really loved school and I loved reading and writing, but you know, even within school, there were maybe like a handful of people that I could talk to about books and some of my creative passions. But then going to Louder Than a Bomb, there were maybe like 1,000 kids there, and all of them, you know, in one corner there'd be people dancing, in another corner there'd be like people freestyling, and there was a DJ playing music, and it made me feel not just like I was writing individually, but like I was part of a community, and it made me feel like, you know, that all of this could be cool and possible, and like, look how exciting this is. So that's how I got started writing poetry. In college, I studied African American studies, which was important to me because it allowed me to kind of gain a multidisciplinary access into the different worlds that I was thinking about. So I wanted to learn history and I wanted to learn English, but I didn't want to study them from the usual perspectives, in part because I was such a new poet. And I just, you know, especially in the early 2000s, all of my teachers kind of emphasized the need to kind of build our own canon. So I was like, the last thing that I want to do is go to college and study the traditional canon when I've been reading writers of color for the last, you know, however handful many of years.
You know, you were talking about your the sort of formal voice in your poem as being informed so much by your siblings, and you also said your cousins, that mm-hmm. it's, you know, it's not necessarily, you know, yourself there in those poems. But I wondered if you could talk about, like, do your siblings and your family, do they read your poems, and what has their response been?
Yeah, so my brothers definitely read my poems. My brother Pedro, who's 1 year younger than me, he's bought maybe like 30 different copies of my book. He recorded an Instagram video of himself recreating like this old rapper video where someone like takes out a bunch of money, like lays it on the floor and then kind of sleeps on them. He did that, but with like a pile of my books, and he's bought them in every format. So he has like a hardcover copy of my book. He has the ebook. He has like 15 paperback copies. I think I've signed like 10 of them or something. So yeah, my brothers and a bunch of my cousins definitely read my poems, definitely read my work. My parents, I think, have a slightly different relationship to my poems just because, you know, they're one, they don't really speak English all that much. And then two, I think they just get a little, you know, they're not necessarily eager to trade in family secrets, you know what I mean? So I think part of them still is a little bit hesitant around that, but they, you know, they're very proud of me. My parents both came to my book release party, and yeah, so yeah, my family's very supportive of me.
Are your parents in Chicago?
Yeah, my parents are in Calumet City, Illinois, which is a suburb south of Chicago.
Jose, would you, I asked you if you'd bring a poem in by another poet to read. Did you bring one?
I did.
Awesome. Would you read it? And would you just say who the poem is by and then read it, and then we'll discuss it after?
Okay, sounds good. So this poem is by Heather McHugh. It's called What He Thought for Fabio Doppliker. We were supposed to do a job in Italy, and full of our feelings for ourselves, our sense of being poets from America, we went from Rome to Fano, met the mayor, mulled a couple matters over. What's cheap date, they asked us. What's flat drink? Among Italian literati, we could recognize our counterparts, the academic, the apologist, the arrogant, the amorous, the brazen and the glib. And there was one administrator, the conservative, in suit of regulation gray, who looked like a good tour guide, with measured pace and uninflected tone, narrated sights and histories the hired van hauled us past. Of all, he was most politic and least poetic, so it seemed. Our last few days in Rome, when all but three of the New World bards had flown, I found a book of poems this unprepossessing one had written. It was there in the pension room, a room he'd recommended, where it must have been abandoned by the German visitor. Was there a bus of them? To whom he had inscribed and dated it a month before. I couldn't read Italian either, so I put the book back into the wardrobe's dark. We last Americans were due to leave tomorrow. For our parting evening then, our host chose something in a family restaurant, and there we sat and chatted, sat and chewed, till, sensible it was our last big chance to be poetic, make our mark, one of us asked, "What's poetry? Is it the fruits and vegetables in marketplace of Campo del Fiore, or the statue there?" Because I was the glib one, I identified the answer instantly. I didn't have to think. "The truth is both. It's both," I blurted out. But that was easy. That was easiest to say. What followed taught me something about difficulty, for our underestimated host spoke out, all of a sudden, with the rising passion, and he said, "The statue represents Giordano Bruno, brought to be burned in the public square because of his offense against authority, which is to say the church. His crime was his belief the universe does not revolve around the human being. God is no fixed point or central government, but rather is poured in waves through all things. All things move. If God is not the soul itself, he is the soul of the soul of the world. Such was his heresy. The day they brought him forth to die, they feared he might incite the crowd. The man was famous for his eloquence, and so his captors placed upon his face an iron mask in which he could not speak. That's how they burned him. That is how he died, without a word in front of everyone. And poetry, we'd all put down our forks by now to listen to the man in gray," he went on softly. "Poetry is what he thought, but did not say."
Oh, I love that poem. Damn, that poem. Yeah.
Had you heard it before?
Yeah,
Do you know it?
I read that poem before, and I was, as you were reading it, I kept thinking, like, there's a turn at the end, and I can't remember what it is. And then I got to re-experience it. Tell me what you love about that poem.
I think... The surprise, I think, because I can feel myself kind of inhabit this world, and I can like see myself at this table and very glibly, you know, saying poetry is everything, and offer, like, I know that I've done that before, offered up this easy answer. And that turn that you're talking about, when the man who's kind of underestimated and has just kind of played his part as a tour guide, and his poetry has been dismissed by, you know, the Americans and the Germans who can't read in Italian. It really kind of takes my breath away, and it makes me remember something true about, or something that feels very true about what the stakes are when we're writing, you know?
And how hard it is to articulate anything, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, about the difficulty. And yeah, and it's a reminder to be patient and to seek beyond the easy answers.
For yourself and for others, you know, mm-hmm. in yourself and in others. There's this like constant sort of judging. Like that's like, you know, there was the academic, the amorous one. And then, you know, you kind of know that something is going to be overturned in this poem.
Yeah, it has to be, right?
Mm-hmm. And the idea that, you know, he's talking about the statue, and he says the man who was put in the iron mask and was it burned?
Yeah, burned.
That he had argued, you know, against the church, or, you know, and had, I love that line about, he says something like that God is, if not the soul, he is.
Yeah,
the
God soul. Is no fixed point or central government, but rather is poured in waves through all things. All things move.
And the soul of the, if not the soul of the world, the soul of the soul of the world, isn't that?
Yeah,
one
if
of
God
lines?
Is not the soul itself, no. He is the soul of the world.
Yes, yeah, and the yeah, I love it. She's such a smart poet. It's so strange that you should read a Heather McHugh poem because we've never mentioned her on this show. And we just finished an interview, and the poet before you, Connie Voisin, I think she said she studied with Heather McHugh.
Oh wow,
she was one of her teachers, I think.
That's cool.
Yeah.
One of the things that I've been doing since my book has come out is returning to read craft books that have been recommended to me by friends. So I read one of Stephen Dobbin's craft books, and he uses a Heather McHugh poem in there that I absolutely love. So I've been kind of slowly working my way through Hinge and Sign, which I think is her selected poems.
That's a great. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great book. I love her. I love Heather McHugh. She's like a mysterious poet to me too.
Yeah.
I can never quite catch up, you know? I love that feeling of like a lot of her poems. I'm like, what the hell's happening in this poem? And why can I not stop reading it? I love it so much.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely hear that.
She's way smart. And she's like a really smart person.
Yeah, and also, you know, she works a lot in narrative, which is also, you know, one of my primary tools as a poet. And so, you know, I think she's like a master craft person. And so as I read her, I'm also thinking about, like, how does she set it up? I mean, like you said, right, the whole time it feels inevitable that in the poem I read, there's going to be a turn. There has to be. And yet I'm still surprised and still captivated when the turn comes. How does she disarm me in that way?
Yeah. Yeah, that's so great. Thank you so much for reading that poem.
Yeah, thank you for asking. I love sharing poems, so thank you for asking me to share a poem.
It's so great to hear poets share poems. I mean, who better to do that? What's that? Okay, yeah, sure. Rebecca wanted me to ask you, since we have just a couple minutes, she wanted me to ask if there was anything that we didn't ask you, and if you wanted to talk about anything that you're sort of championing right now?
Things that I'm championing. Well, I guess one thing that I'd like to mention is, so right now, the other thing that I'm working on is editing the forthcoming poetry anthology, The Breakbeat Poets, Volume 4, Latinx. It'll be out in April 2020. And reading through so many Latinx poets and seeing so many poets be in conversation, I think has kind of started to kind of crack me open, and like getting a chance to kind of look at the field a little bit more broadly has been really fascinating. And where like different stories echo and where they kind of split and part has been fascinating to look at.
Who are some of the poets that knocked your socks off?
The first poet that comes to mind is Yesenia Montilla. She is a poet living in New York City, uptown, and her poems are breathtaking. They're really great, really sharp. The pacing is really right. Like it's once you start reading her poems, it's hard to stop. And just another person that's really, really a great craft person. So her poems come to mind. I just looked at some Javier Zamora's poems, and Javier is incredible. And I'm really excited about his poems. And then another person that I think I'm always in conversation with is the poet Joseph Rios, out of Fresno originally. But his poems, I think, kind of have a similar, or maybe not a similar voice, but I think his voice is very much in the same family as my voice. So it's really great to read his poems and to see how he's thinking about the world.
That's awesome. Great. All right. Thank you again so much. And thank you for like going to a studio to do this. I know that that's not an easy thing.
Oh, no, it's all good. Thank you, Carrie.
Take care.
Thank you, Rebecca.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye.
You can find Jose Olivares' poem Mexican-American Disambiguation in his book Citizen Illegal, out now from Haymarket Books.
This Is Just to Say is produced at KUT Radio in Austin, Texas. I'm Carrie Fountain. Thanks for listening.